preloaded, like not just address books, but things that actually catalyze groups. I don't know when he's going to show, so I'll be getting it for the first time, which the particular project is you. But for the last part of the class, we'll ask him to do that. That actually nicely fits into the theme of the sort of structure of the class, because this is the last week of purely economic and sociological observation about groups without a significant technological component. Next week, we're going to start turning our attention to, we've got a list of attributes and that groups have and problems they suffer from, and now what can we do about it? Because the questions we've answered up until now are, why are groups special? What problems do they have? We haven't yet answered, why ITP, why 2005? And that's not so much today, but next week we'll be turning our attention to that. So Jones will be in the class, tease that up next week. So let me start by asking, two weeks ago, the John C. DeBrown and Paul Duguid reading, Social Life of Information. We did not talk about that in class, but you may have recognized the parallel between the story of the Xerox repair people and the paper you've written. This is Matt. I was just telling him, you've got to come join us.
I think it's the happiest place on earth.
So the story from Social Life of Information is very similar to the setup of the paper, in that the Xerox repair people were a kind of a latent group, and the corporation didn't even know they existed. And when they followed them around, like the idea of the Xerox repair person is, it's a Xerox machine, right? It's a device, it acts in completely mechanistic and predictable ways. So here's the official Xerox manual for repair. You take that manual out to the field, the machine breaks, you look up the error code, and you fix the machine. Right? And that was Xerox's view of how the situation worked. What was the truth?
It wasn't at all the case.
Right.
The machines behave, so to speak.
Right. As we know, even completely deterministic devices act in non-deterministic ways. So what was wrong with the Xerox model? And the Xerox model is a kind of a star topology of we're in the center, we are Xerox, we can build these machines, we know how they work. And we send the reps out individually to the field, and they fix the machines. What was wrong with that model?
We really have to make sure it's a more informal social group structure.
Where did the real information, how did the real information get out?
Just in conversation and in like social meetings, but it wasn't formal.
I guess I meant more how did it get across from one repair version to the next.
Well, they talked about it at lunch. You know, for example, like not the way that they had the thing structured now, there wasn't much communication between the people officially.
Right.
They took it upon themselves to meet, you know, outside of work setting.
And so, what did they do?
There's stories about like what had happened.
No, but I mean, literally, what forum did they meet in? Since there was no official support for
the coffee shop,
right? They met at breakfast, right? So this is one of those places where I actually did this my first year here. I wanted to see sort of group forming characteristics. I wanted to understand things about group forming characteristics on the floor. So I bought a bunch of pizzas one day. And I came in at 6 and I just set the pizzas up. No other announcement. What I discovered is that everybody at ITP is starving all the time. And, like, every time the door rolls down the hall with a cart of food, it's bare. It's like a carrot. So that's one of those where breakfast has the sort of same characteristics. There's a logical, or there's a kind of innate need to get together. Over food, it's a fairly deep social pattern, and they use that as a way to find a place to have these kind of informal conversations. The conversations not only weren't sanctioned by Xerox, they didn't know about it, and yet, like, that network made Xerox millions of dollars a year, or saved them millions a year in repair costs. Right? What did ITP work like that? LFTP is like the Xerox.
The firmware lab back there.
Right. That would be my number one choice. What else? Why do you? What goes on in the firmware lab that makes it like right?
Well, it's like there's people there who might know your answer, like sitting around. So I was talking to somebody who, like, you know, trying to set up their own PIC programmer and whatnot. But it's like, it's great, but like, you got to be in that room if you want to get things done on time.
Well, I would have said the drive-bys, because they're not officially sanctioned by ITP, but you have people there that are trying to learn something, people who are trying to get information out to.
But that's a formalization, like, in itself.
So the drive-bys are recognized by the institution to a degree now. How?
Space.
Right. So they're scheduled. So they're starting. We drew the graph last week. Drive-bys are moving into being more formalized at a later time. The firmware lab, the social network, the firmware lab is less formal.
The lab even work because it's not tend to be a space like even the firmware is the space that defined as working for a specific medium. And lab is just, I mean, I was the other day asking somebody a question and they didn't know the answer, and then probably someone else heard me asking the question and they came towards me and like, I know how to do it, and they just showed me how to do it. Was it
someone you knew?
No, someone from first year.
I remember right when the .com fling happened, we got the incoming first year class had all left. .com jobs, rather than the .com jobs left now. And the incoming class came in with a significantly higher amount of just raw technical chops than the existing second year class.
And by the middle of the first semester, that had sort of gone out. And the second years were telling the first year sort of, how it is at ITP, here's what you should look out for, here's the class you take, here's the class you should avoid, whatever. And the first year was saying, here's how you do this, here's how you program this, here's how you get out of this problem. And it was a sort of a, and the technical chops have now stayed higher since then. But it was fun to see those sort of two eras crossing. So what's the difference between the firmware lab and the lab? What's the advantage and disadvantage of each?
Firmware labs focused around specific problems. So, like, when you have Xerox repairmen talking, and they're just talking shit, but, like, they're going to talk about their machines anyhow.
Right.
It's the same sort of thing in the firmware lab. Everyone's doing their PCOMP, you know.
Right.
Whereas in the lounge, it's not that focused, you know. If they happen to know your problem as you're walking by,
you might or you might not find your solution well in the firm lab. You know that it's a more specified space.
But in the lounge, you can assume the availabilities of other people around you more than in the firmware lab. In a sense, kind of discussions can go on, and you can actually, people are there. They're not doing their work.
But the discussions in the firmware lab are specified on a specific topic. So. It would be quite a long shot to believe that somebody in the lounge will catch your will hear you talking and will have the answer for you if we're trying to speak like in solving problems in focus. So it's more specific.
Mm-hmm.
There are totally different rules in terms of availability. Because if you're in the lounge, you're saying that you're somewhat available to talk about anything. And in the firmware lab, it's that you're actually really working on trying to concentrate on something. So even though there's that kind of dialogue in the firmware lab for finding your answers, there's a totally different etiquette in terms of like when you ask something and what it should be that you ask. So if you're going to interrupt somebody's focus for it,
add the mailing list. What's the difference between the lounge and the mailing list and the firm on that?
It's hard. Is it removal from a live?
More formal? A bit more formal, in a way.
Which is more formal?
The mailing list.
Because?
There should be a request for an answer and then a reply. It's not on the fly. It's not like a
which gets the idea of synchrony, that the email is asynchronous, and so you don't have to be synchronous.
I would say that it's typed. There's a way to reflect behind the limits of twice.
So you, right, you can't have the freedom to say pretty much anything in a conversation and have it wash away doesn't exist as much in the manner.
There's a bit more of a memory to the main English, but still it's quite short term. So in all of these cases, kind of, you get that information at a specific informal context in time, and then it goes away.
But on the fly does happen, like, you know, going out for food order in 20 minutes.
He's the one.
You know? What?
He's the one. You're the one that, from my example.
But yeah, so the you know, food going out, food order going out in 20 minutes, who wants to come, put your order in.
How often does that happen?
Not that often, because it's way more effective to just go out in the lounge and yell it. Right?
So why is it more effective to do that?
Because it hits the desired audience, like people who are actually there and might be wanting food, whereas the list hits like somebody sitting, you know, like at home or like, and they check it, they might check it 3 hours later and be like, oh.
But then there's also the emails for people computing as the SDM video that is very specified, so you can rely on these mailing lists to get an answer after, like, if you do apply with a question.
In fact, personally, for me, the ITP students mailing list doesn't work for me. I use only the smallest that are specified around something specific. Even if I'm losing a lot of information, that might be relevant to me.
What kind of questions are you asking?
In the specific.
Well, no. You're saying it doesn't work for the general. I'm just curious what kind of questions you.
When I'm asking a question, I do follow, but. It's really hard for me to just go and read what's going on there.
But I just mean, like, is it a technical question, or is it more of a, like, a general idea?
You're saying that it's overwhelming, I guess.
Yeah,
but
too much.
I opened a Gmail account for that, and that wasn't enough as well, so I created a filter that would make sure that every mail I get from the student list is automatically read, because I can't even bear to see it unread. It's just so overwhelming.
This is interesting. I was thinking about this mailing list, because I subscribe to the mailing list as a daily digest, and it works drastically different, because you don't get those, you know, food going out in 20-minute emails, you know? I was in the lab when that happened. I didn't hear an announcement. And then half an hour later, I see a bunch of people eating food. Right? And I'm like, how the heck did this happen? And that was just a very personal, you know. So it works very differently, I think, how you receive it, how you participate in it. So I was very curious how people use it.
Earl, you were shaking your head when you heard that.
I had a few comments about the mailingness. Being a person whose forte is not physical computing, I think that the mailing is a way to, like, announce your level of, like, if you ask a question that is technical, you're kind of putting yourself out there as to what level of difficulty you have, and it's recorded. Whereas if you ask somebody in the lab, or if you ask one of the instructors, then you can just get that information without putting yourself on the spot.
Well, the mailing list has a really annoyingly short archive. Like, it constantly is.
What's true of all of these solutions we've listed so far?
And another thing is that I see the mailing list as a resource. I put it in it. I have a rule, so it goes to a specific folder, and it has a different color, so it doesn't get mixed up with my other email. And then from there, I just search by title, and whatever's interesting, I put into a different folder, and I delete it.
Wow.
And right now, I'm like 3,000 backups that I haven't reviewed, but I only review if it's interesting, and there's a level of credibility as to who sent it. Not so much this year, but as of last year, we had different members of the list that I just wouldn't even take in consideration.
Right.
So I have a whole mechanism of like just trying.
Can you export your setting?
I can show you my rules. And
it's really annoying though that the meta, there's no, like it archives for like 2 weeks or something. And
hasn't Dennis set up a Gmail account that does nothing but archive the list?
Yeah, but then it's like you got to remember how the hell to get to that account.
How's our own?
It's like, which is, yeah, so you like have to search back through the list somehow.
So what's that problem?
That's a memory problem.
We have lots of good ways of moving things outside of memory into other things, but the list doesn't have that. Neither obviously the firm or lab in the lounge.
I have two questions for you, but before I say that, I've always felt that like with the physical computing end of it, it's great that there are resources available, like students nearby, but there's never been like an archive available. Like if I had an issue with something else that's more generalized, like if I have a programming issue, I could just go to groups.google.com or some specified group and look it up. There's nothing like that for physical computing. But what I was going to ask you two questions. I don't know if it's directly related to this, but like, were you here when they initiated the lister?
No, that started in 96. That was Sean Kelly's.
Okay.
I think it was about 5 years before.
I was wondering how they got it started up and what kind of incentives they had to try and get it populated. But
I think Sean did it on his own. I'll ask him. But I think Sean did it on his own, and it later, like the Drivewise, migrated to being more hosted by, and then ultimately became a sort of a key resource.
Well, but Tori actually like regulates who's on the list now.
You all weren't around for the SS fiasco, were you? There was a member of the list of Mr. Judy, member of the list of named SS, and I have a very interesting view of the list since I'm not allowed to subscribe. I only hear about the things that are really, crises or big. I heard that Bala was getting married, for example. 2 years ago, the big thing was SS, and SS was on as a really vicious flame baiter and troller, and because SS was anonymous and posting from either a Hotmail or a Gmail address, no one could trace him or her back. I think it was him. And so they had this problem came up. This person was in and really doing nothing but trying to, launching, attacks on both individuals and the program. And it wasn't clear if they were a current student or a former student or how they had gotten there. And so you have this conundrum. What do you do about this person? Because they've gotten to the point of being fundamentally destructive. What were the institution's options at that point? What could possible reactions to that problem?
They could block or close. I guess they could technically close their account, but then there runs a threat that they could just create another account.
Right. They could shut off that email address, but then they can potentially come back under another.
Remove the possibility of posting anonymously, so having only NYU accounts.
Right.
Have somebody contact the person. Instead of having that person who was posted to the list, have somebody from administration, someone with some kind of air of authority.
Do what?
Contact the person.
Oh, I'm trying to engage them in a dialogue outside the list.
Exactly.
That's right. I don't think we tried. That's interesting.
Was that when Midori became the
liaison? The reason Midori is the gatekeeper of the list was the SS fiasco, right? So that's a case where we'll see this over and over again. The way the network works, in part reflects the technological aspects of email, and in part reflects the social nature of the purpose of the list. So Midori was added as a gatekeeper. We couldn't go to Mona's solution with only NYU addresses. Why not? Why couldn't we just use valid
people
NYU
use other
people use other addresses? It would actually reduce the value of the list. So Midori is essentially set up as make sure only NYU students, right, the students and I think alumni after 1 year are on the list.
Which
and that's
kind of a weird thing.
Right, so why is that weird?
Well, it's because there's only like a few people read it and there's like a few like anonymous alumni who post. Like, last year there was one who was like only posted negative things, right?
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean,
pretty much got like shunned off the list because it was like, well, what? Graduated already, like why the hell are you like yelling at first years?
Oh, I don't know what you're
talking about. No, I was just curious, I didn't know if there was some kind of trend that was trackable where, I guess the alumni list encompasses everybody who's ever attended ITB, is that correct?
Potentially encompasses, obviously the subscription is a
subset of that. I don't know what fraction.
I don't think there's as much of a, you know, there's not as much back and forth as like the current student list.
No, the alumni list is more active.
They have jobs.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, but they also, there's more posts. Like, I'm on the alumni list too.
There are more posts for the alumni list than for the mailing list?
Yeah, well, there's probably a lot more members. And the subject's a little, like, there's different subjects. It's different. There'd be, like, more political posts or, like.
That's interesting. You can shut the list off. You can shut the list off, right. That's another decision. It was, it was discussed, and not seriously, because it was too much value, right? But when you think, I mean, as we said last week, if you're not having bad ideas, you're not having enough ideas. And that was an idea that was floated about what to do with the list.
Plus, I mean, if you shut it off, basically he wins, or whoever SS is gets his way,
exactly right.
And
exactly right.
causes the destruction that he or she was after to begin. Right.
And the list is, as good as the labs aren't as good as the firmware lab, the list is breakfast around here. That is the probably the closest analog to that Xerox breakfast. And other than Midori as gatekeeper, none of the faculty and staff are allowed to be on it.
Gordy is on.
Oh, yes, I didn't know that.
Well, Gordy probably just posts anonymously, right?
Yes.
Gordy sends out to
Gordy
sends out to the announcement list.
No,
announcement
goes
to the list.
He
but
has
commented
Gloria.
On
a post that I sent
Gloria
to the list.
Gloria's on that.
Right. No, she's a student, right?
Yeah.
Right, but I'm not allowed to be on the list. I couldn't look at it if I wanted to. And that's in part to preserve the breakfast-like characteristics of, you know, nobody is around. It's a completely flat structure, as with breakfast.
Reminds me, I wrote about that in my paper. I guess faculty's allowed to, like, sit and hang out in the lounge?
Allowed to, sure.
Okay. Well, it's just that I haven't really ever seen it. I mean, there's no reason that you guys would have it anyway. You guys have your own offices. But
I do it sometimes.
Some people
have.
Some people
are.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Some
yeah.
Not many, but some.
Yeah. Can I have a paperback?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
more of a social thing. If we're meeting with a student, it's probably more appropriate to do it in the office because we don't know if what the student is talking about, to Carol's point, what the student is talking about needs to be in private or public.
The reason I figured it was that way is because I know you guys aren't allowed on the listserv, and I figured that
the lounge is the physical analog.
Yeah, where, like, you know, a lot of groups do meet up for classes, and I feel kind of weird if I'm working on, you know, somebody's project and the instructor's right next to us and we're talking about it.
You know what? I think part of it is last year, Hollybeck used to go around banging the pot to get lunch going. And the loss of the lunch table, the reconstruction, so there's no big lunch table, seems to me to be a change that's maybe moved some of that social life. And maybe Todd's busy too, I don't know, maybe, you know, those kinds of things can happen. But there was much more faculty and residents presence in the lounge last year than this year. So here's an open question, and it's in the spirit of the papers. It really is an open question. We've come up to the edge of the question, but there's no obvious answer to that. We're proposing next year moving to wiring, which is the processing-based manipulation tool for creating and modeling physical circuits. If we move to wiring, it's open source. And we no longer have the restriction of having a limited number of licenses, at which point the firmware lab can go away. Or it can become more general. And having decommissioned a couple of other labs that seem to use, now that Wi-Fi is around, we have more flexibility on the floor. Having decommissioned the long lab, but how do we do that anymore with the firmware lab? And then we came up to the edge of the social capital question around people doing PCOM, which of all the disciplines has the least general familiarity for an incoming first year class. Fewer people opt out of PCOM than anything else. Should we decommission the firmware lab if we go open source?
No, I don't think so.
David says no.
Okay.
No.
Say yes.
Okay. You guys fight it out.
I'm just looking at it. You have the point that it's open source, and I mean, I don't know. I see a trend of a lot of things moving towards open source, and I think inevitably, if you keep the firmware lab around, it's probably going to be like, you know, it's going to be a dinosaur, and you know.
You wouldn't stop us from moving to open source. That change is already in the works. Really, just when wiring gets good enough, we're switching. That's the only question. Now, that decision has been taken. It's really.
Do you do away with the room?
It's the social path.
Yeah.
Is there an advantage of having a standing social network of people working on PCOM problems as a special case within this institution?
I think
it's not. There's also a video
lab.
Oh, that's right.
It's the nature of the equipment that you're working on, and also the nature of the projects that you're producing. You know, it's one thing to sit around the lounge and ask an anonymous question and have somebody overhear you, but it's a whole other thing to come up with this bundle of gear.
Right.
You know what I mean?
the nature of the problems that occur in physical computing are different. They're much harder to pin down and say, you got a video problem. Well, you can pretty specifically say, like, this is this problem or a programming problem. You're like, okay, this is what I need to do. But in physical computing, it's much more holistic. It's like, it could be the wires, it could be the code, it could be your PIC program.
Yeah, it's specialized equipment that's used to diagnose those problems. Okay. Like the video lab, for example, requires specialized stuff.
I think you should, change what configuration of the room, you know, make it more like a workshop, an extension of that, because you don't need the computers necessarily to use your own, but you'll still need the other equipment, such as the soldering irons and the
Some people will need the computers.
And you don't want to really do that in the lounge where people are eating and other things.
I think, another part of it is, related to that, all the little kind of odd and end things that you need to do physical computing, all the drawers and that hold the capacitors and the LEDs and all that kind of stuff. Well, where are you going to put all that stuff? If you dissolve the lab, then where's the
parts? This is the deal with software licenses. This still doesn't. See, I've always thought with BCOMP that really what anchored people here was the hardware portion. If you wanted to rip the software off of one of those firm lab machines, you could find a way.
Sure.
If you really wanted to do it,
you
can drag and drop it.
Is that rip?
Yeah.
So if the machines are not tethered in that room by software licenses, should they be tethered in that room by social capital? That's essentially the question.
But either way, we've got this connector that rides to the thing. We need that somewhere.
That thing costs $90.
What?
Like the little machine costs $90. You can go buy your own. It's not that expensive.
Did you buy it?
No. But I need to. That's the thing.
He's offering to lend you the money.
The software costs another $200, and that's where. And then once you're at $300, that's a different level of expense than a $90 PC.
I know people who have bought it and that they can work at home, but they still sometimes choose to work here.
I was going to say, I think almost the class of physical computing almost trains people to work, in that lab, because after the first assignment, it's kind of like you have the comfort of everybody else in the classes around you or people you know. You can ask questions, or at least you can feel just as lost. So,
if you're just getting into physics, that's my intuition.
I find many times that how space legitimizes the kind of work we're doing, and having that space available for us kind of lets us do the kind of work that we can do here. I think unless that space really, maybe the scale of work or the time we spend with this kind of work would totally change, and it really defines what kind of thing. Just imagine that we didn't have video lab, what kind of work we would have done it.
You just got Final Cut Pro on your machines or whatever.
Right.
The wiring program sounds like it still has hardware you have to have. You have to have a way to go out of your Mac on this Mac base to obtain. Go to it, so that's why I just wish that we could check like programmers off the floor. That's the problem with the firmware lab. If you're going to do it, you have to do it here. Like, I'd like to be able to take it on site.
So
and it's really kind of absurd because there are more PIC programmers than machines that can use it, by twice as many right now.
Sure.
But you're not allowed to take them off the floor for some reason.
I was just going to say that there's a discipline in steps that's associated with physical computing, that is, it's sort of required to work a certain way in the shop, and then when you're ready, leave that environment. And the same way as if in the video lab, you had the equipment rental room there, and maybe you have a studio that you could shoot in. You don't do that. You actually proceed back and forth. You edit some footage, you go back, and you shoot. It's the same thing. You build, and then you program, and you go back and forth. And it would just be a chaotic mess at that moment. And some of the rules disappeared, and the people were trying to program in the shop and taking a desk space to program and have thick programmers. I think you needed a discipline that you do.
I almost think too that people that become experienced with that type of stuff, because I wouldn't purchase a thick programmer. I had no interest in physical computing, so I didn't mind coming in here to do it. Plus, I worked with other people in the project. But I would think that somebody who, once they get to that point where they're experienced enough and they can take it home with them, they might purchase it. But then on the other hand, I wouldn't be surprised to see them on the floor often, because it's helpful. It's best for the community to share information.
Jamie and Chris lived in that room
Yeah.
during their thesis. And they could have done that work anyway. They had everything they needed.
All right, so
and
like
Too Fast for Tracks and oops, oh, the crazy music thing. Both happened there.
Ever been in it. I just had a question. What's the, I'm probably going to sound like Patch Adams or something. Is it a funny room?
That's right.
Is it, do people laugh there?
Not that really. They get nervous. Yes.
It's
very informal.
Is it? Yeah. Yes, there was a phrase that Stephen Johnson used about the biochemistry of a room and how the biochemistry of a room gets channeled. It was part of this internal debate about back channels in IRC and in conferences and events and things like that, and how all of the snark and laughter and everything goes into the IRC and sucks out of the room once you have symbolic digital technologies sucking out of that. And if you're in a physical place doing things, being in the world, working in a shop, the biochemistry room is very different. And is that a thing there? You said it's brutal. I mean,
it's the worst.
I was seeing more, but that was more in terms of the physical conditions of the room, of like lighting, temperature, mindset of people in there. It's like one of the, for me, my experience, my worst experiences are in the room.
I always loved shop at school, so. But I was just wondering whether it was something to do with.
Well, the environment's the environment's pretty harsh. It's like the least nice room, but it's also the only room that's allowed to get messy in the entire place. It's just like you can leave stuff there, and like people won't touch it or clean it up. Whereas every other room gets clean.
Is that set by a social norm, or is there a set of rules that makes that?
No, it's pretty. Like I'm in the ER, so I close sometimes, and like you're supposed to clean up like little crap. Most of it's totally clean, but that room, you're like you don't want to touch people's projects and wires. They're delicate.
I bet that's social. I definitely
specify. Oh no, it's totally social. There's no like, and like Rob actually has complained about it, eh? But at the same time, he's like he knows that like he can't really touch it. You know,
he's a neat freak too.
Yeah,
which
like,
is great at thesis. I mean, the thesis room ran amazingly last year, but it's the antithesis of that space. Check.
Oh, I was just gonna read. I think it's totally a social thing. I mean, I remember my cleaning up for the first time. I didn't see the checklist, and I was thinking, you know, like, what do I do? Do I like, clean up with all this crap? And I'm like, don't touch it. I'm like, oh, of course, I'm not going to touch it, but what else am I supposed to do?
I think, in terms of the nature of people, and then there's a certain amount of, like, recognizing you know, people who are interested in it. There's also, like, a value in being in that room and being frustrated, and then seeing other people, like, accomplish their goals, because it's like, everyone in that room is miserable. There's often that point where it's like, you get it to work, and you're like, oh, my God, yes, it's like this sort of moment of exaltation, where if I was doing it at home, I would most likely give up and stop working at some point.
Yeah,
but it's like, to see other people kind of like, oh, I'm eventually going to get through this, you're part of like a community.
There's a little like slot machine effect, because like everyone's
yeah.
like suffering, and all of a sudden like someone's like,
you can't
do high fives by yourself.
Right.
And there is, I'm sure there's something to that social machine. I'd be interested in the dynamics of the video lab, like how does that differ from that must, I mean, my sense is that that's certainly a quieter environment. I don't spend so much time.
I had a summer video, well, I had two summer video classes, and it was a different dynamic because it was a smaller community of video people, but we would have a lot of our critiques in the video lab where we went to class and nobody would say anything because we had already, like, because it was an intense class, we were all working there together, and we would, because it was a smaller class, we were more likely to ask each other for feedback. So there was a good dynamic of feedback that was going on there.
You said the critiques worked better in that room than in the class?
Well, no, I just felt like a lot of the critique was already done by the time we went to class, because we had already talked about each other's projects. So I that might have been a more unique experience because it was summer, because it was a more intense class in a smaller group.
But the problem with all this stuff, it's so multidimensional. You change one or two variables, the whole thing can either sit there because the group corrects for it, or you know, they can ramify and become a completely different situation.
It seems like the PCOM assignments, I haven't taken a video class, but it seems most people in the video class are working on their own projects, where PCOM is a group kind of project, and you're dealing in relation to this class, it seems more group-oriented than, and that's why it's quieter, possibly, with headphones.
I think that the video, it's more
if you do get into it, you get it. I've never done it before, then I just got into it and like,
it works.
I got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But then in PCOM, there would be like five people helping me, and they would do it, but I was not able to actually get it done otherwise.
So back to the Xerox repair people, what after Steve Brown and Dubin discovered this, what did they do?
What did Xerox do?
Yeah. You remember the intervention, what they did for the Xerox repair people after they discovered they were having breakfast?
Didn't they try to assemble some sort of, I don't know if it was like a formalized database, but they tried to figure out who knew what and create a system where they can actually put all of this information together and then allow the repair workers to tap it?
They did do some of that. Yeah, they went down the knowledge management.
Right, and they also, I think, created some sort of award ceremony where they recognized who was giving out the most information or something like that.
But they gave them something.
Didn't they just get ratings? Or just
yeah,
like
getting
more
ratings. In addition to the recognition from the company, the value they gave walkie-talkies. What do the walkie-talkies do?
Put them in touch.
East communication.
Yeah.
They extended some of the breakfast mentality throughout the day.
It's a business service.
What's that?
It's a business service.
It's kind of like a little service. What's the disadvantage? And it's true of all of these solutions we've talked about so far. What's the disadvantage of those solutions in terms of building up, say, a knowledge base?
Well, I think that if you have people working independently and they, for better or worse, have this almost fear that they have to get their job done, they have to work on their own, then they're more driven to know as much as they can individually. Whereas if you have a wide dissemination of knowledge, you'll inevitably get some people who, I don't know, I'll just call somebody. And so it could conceivably, although raising the level of the group overall, lower the level of certain individuals who
are coasting or
exactly.
You also mentioned the importance of short-term memory. And like, if, and especially with the Xerox people, like if you have a radio, you might ask somebody a question and get the answer right away and then just forget about it. Whereas before they were rehearsing stories, so it had a longer like memory and they could go over the same story, tell the story to different people, and it was just kind of for a continuation.
And the radio thing, it has even less tangibility than email. So once you bring it in the answer, nothing exists except in the minds of two people communicating. It's obviously an issue with ICT. The wiki seems to be the solution for that now. I don't know. You know, we talked about the spam problem, but sort of long-term, like, remember that this is here, remember. The kinds of things that used to be asked, as I understand it, sort of every week on the mailing list, some of those in my address.
But that essential intervention in this conversation is a big part of what we'll be doing, you know, particularly to turn our attention to more technological issues, which is look at a group, try to understand the dynamics, including understanding that there's a big difference between efficiency and effectiveness. Right? Efficiency is about lowering the overall cost of doing an activity. Effectiveness is about raising the quality of which the activity is done. And it would be hard to get anybody to come in and say at a first glance, oh, it's efficient to have this breakfast. Right? It takes up their time, they're schmoozing, they get to work late or whatever, but it's certainly effective. And in social systems, effectiveness is often privileged at the expense of efficiency, which is hard for people to understand at first, but often works a lot better. ITP is hardly the most efficient institution in the world, but there are lots and lots of mechanisms for information transfer and sort of experimentation. So we'll be looking for places where, and you know, as with the papers, there is some situation in which you can imagine making an intervention, like adding radios to the situation. Or, you know, what would happen if we put, say, a machine that sold food in that room? Right? You can see how that would radically change the learning characteristics of the room.
Or a coffee machine.
Right,
exactly. What would the difference be between a machine that sold sandwiches and a machine that sold coffee? So the interventions do not themselves have to be necessarily social in their first order characteristics, as breakfast is not breakfast, it's about getting food. But the social component of that breakfast add a lot to the effectiveness of the Xerox. So, let me ask a leading question before I read the papers. What did you find either interesting or frustrating about the experience of doing the paper? So good or bad, what was it like to have that assignment go out after describing groups and describing intervention?
I found it's... Actually, I didn't have as much difficulty writing it as I thought I would, but I almost felt like it's totally hypothetical, so it was very difficult for me to try and think of information that would reinforce what I was thinking and have it steadfastly prove it.
Right.
You know?
Right. You can't. I mean, you can't prove. This is the thing. It really is just a hypothesis, but it later becomes one you could potentially.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I don't think I've ever written a paper like that. So.
I had actually the most difficult time picking a group and deciding which group to work with. And I had such a problem with the hypothesis that I actually decided to do the intervention.
See what happened.
And begin exploring it in the real world. So that was just my personal experience.
Well, what did you do?
Can you share what happened? I'm really curious.
Well, I was looking at, we were talking about TNO, so I decided to have a TNO for first years on Tuesdays, I was just started looking at reactions of first year, second year, people were coming up to me and saying, how can you do this, are you boycotting TNO? There was a lot of reaction, but there was also a lot of positive feedback. Oh, this is something that we need, this is something, that first year's need or whatever it was. So.
Thursday night out every night at 9.
We have Thursdays in my country too.
So Thursdays at 9 is the beginning of the sort of period of socializing and developing steam. And as a result, we don't have classes here on Friday mornings. except now Jean-Marc does.
Thanks.
And so Tuesday night out. Did you do a Tuesday night out?
Yeah, we did a Tuesday night out.
It's not Tuesday night out.
It's Thursday night out on Tuesday. That's what I got. Yeah,
TNO.
TNOOT.
And how many people showed up?
About 18 people.
How big is the TNO on average?
Much more.
Easily double the
trip. Right, yeah. Okay.
But aren't we just looking for occasions to go?
What else?
Yeah.
What else about the papers?
But you didn't do it in BBQ during the middle of Red's class?
Oh, okay.
You can get more than 18 people to do that.
I kind of felt like, on the one hand, there wasn't enough to write, and on the other hand, I felt like I could have written forever about some of this stuff.
Right. I'm surprised by the first reaction. So what was it that seemed thin about it?
Well, I didn't want to write about stuff that I thought seemed fairly obvious. I didn't want to go into explaining something that I thought was already kind of embedded in there.
Right,
already.
We're part of the same tribe, so there's certain things you don't describe, right.
So then, but then when I thought about it, I'm like, and I guess part of it, I mean, if I step back one step in the argument, part of it is, who am I actually writing the paper for? Am I writing it for you? Obviously I am writing for you, for the class, but then if I were to look at this from a perspective of a more general audience, then all this stuff would require as much. And then when I got right down to what it is that I really wanted to say, I discovered so many different angles that I'm like, well, there's no way I could possibly.
One of the reasons I ask people to choose one intervention is the number of things you could even do before you start assessing the effects is so enormous.
One social intervention you can make with a group is to get an invited idiot to come along and ask stupid questions. What was your assignment?
Sorry, your assignment was pick a group at ITU. So model on the socialized of information. They went out, they discovered this latent group at Xerox that existed that they didn't know about. They said, oh my god, these guys are creating tons of value by figuring out how to repair these machines when they don't actually work for free. We're going to add walkie-talkies. The assignment was pick a group at ITP, either existing or latent. It can be a class, it can be an association, it can be whatever. And then first describe the group, then imagine one intervention.
All right, good. Thanks for that. Thanks.
You're welcome. All right. So I want to turn now to the more recent readings. And in particular, the Wilfred Bion experiences and groups and the Mansh Olson logic and collective action. What's the same about those readings? They're obviously radically different in terms. One is psychology and groups, the other is pure economics, so pure that I had to rip out the part with all of the equations. Because that was you know, not the kind of thing we're talking about in class. And yet, there's one thing that's the same about it. There's a basic tension, there's a tension at the base of both papers.
Between the individual and the group.
Right.
That's it. They're both of those papers are about how is it that individuals and groups, what's the tension between the relationship individuals and groups? So let's start with the Bion, which is experiences in groups. Bion's obviously doing group psychotherapy. And let's reimagine that paper as if you were talking about graduate school instead of group psychotherapy. Drawing deeper parallels, I will exercise the reader. But what are the effects that show up in this kind of environment that are similar to what Bion is talking about?
I was looking, I wish I had read this earlier before I started my paper, because I was thinking exactly this kind of thing. Like in ITP, you have this group, you have like the social, you know, whatever community, but there are so many people who are like, well, you know, I'm just here, I'm doing my own thing, I'm not a first year, I'm not a second year, I'm not, you know, a video person, you know, whatever background I come from, you know, like they want to exert their complete individuality. Yet in being part of the group at ITP, a level of that, you know, has to kind of go away and be in being part of a group.
Right. There's an absolute tension between, it's permanent, as we've already mentioned, that there's a permanent standing tension between autonomy and group membership. The kind of effects that Bion mentions, what's similar between this situation, I mean specifically a class, not just ITP in general, and the situation by
itself? Personalization, like who gets more out of the class, like asking or just being passive in the class, and like who are you advocating? Like it's a problem someone is posing, you might spend more time on that problem than the other person might be more shy or not.
Different.
Yeah, like, Not willing to actually share and not get as much from the class.
Yeah. I mean, there's also like a tension in class. Like, you know, what you talked about, like, a lot is this idea of, like, individual relationship, like, the leader of the group.
Yeah.
Or it's like the teacher. It's like you have the feeling like you're only getting, like, value out of when the teachers are talking to you about your project rather than about, like, sort of, you know, sort of saying, like, well, the real value comes like, listening to all the other conversations going around it, perhaps. But people don't like have a really hard time recognizing that.
I found interesting when he points out the transition between the state where there's individuals and when they become a group, and that's where an outside force, which is him in that case, intervenes in that group, and then these individuals are grouping or becoming one because there's that in outside force. And I see a lot of Hollywood movies are very much dealing with that problem, this outside enemy in the whole work together.
And nothing like that. Nothing
yeah.
like an enemy cause a group to solidify.
Right, exactly.
It's not only any movie.
Yeah. No, right, exactly. Movies do
no,
it.
No, but they kind of like, you know, take
yeah.
concentrated and
they make
the whole
they
issue.
Make it obvious.
Yeah. So, I mean.
Well, movie analogy as well. The leader can also be the enemy. So, yeah, you are
right.
not a beautiful, unique snowflake.
Right, the enemy within the group. But then also, then the individuals, they come together to find that
people
enemy.
Against the government.
Yeah.
It's always a
I mean,
group.
For example, yeah.
a group that, that is right comparing to someone who is terribly wrong.
So do you remember a moment where the whole room stopped and everybody looked to me to solve the problem? What was it?
You mean in first class?
Yeah.
During the first class.
What happened?
What happened? I think you tried to duck, Dan.
I did. I pulled my chair out of the way because
right.
I was getting much too much attention. But what happened? What led the group to just stop and everybody looked at me?
Oh, well, that was it. Yeah,
I was just going to say, you're technically our leader. Well, there's that.
Right, but right. Do I have magical powers?
No.
Would it be nice
we all agree that
you're
the head of the table under the.
Right, exactly. No, right. There's positional aspects of all this, but there's yeah.
And you set the rules as well. You set the rules that started the action in the first place.
That's right. But if when I said get together in pairs, individual pairs didn't come up to me and ask you how to decide. What was it that made everybody stop and look at me?
The size.
Right. So when we got to the scale, where the coordination problem was beyond, right, when there's even half a dozen people around the room, you could kind of look at each other and coordinate. But when two groups of 12 have to smash into becoming a group of 24, you look for some way to lower the coordination.
I would say that if we had another group of 48, if we had another level, we might not have turned to. Because we knew that now the decision is going to be.
It was the last step.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Right, so it may in fact have not been just the scale, but also the finality.
Well, you also like set up the exercise and divide it in pairs, and so like there's a certain precedent.
But the interesting thing is, right, that at no other point in the exercise did people stop and look at me. There's only one other time where people asked me to intervene when, I think David, it was you, said, can we draw straws? Right, trying to get out of the group decision-making process in another way. Why?
It's also the only time when we were all situated in the same, I'm using the same word, in the same situation. We were all stated in the same situation where we all had to take the same decision versus the situation where each one was in smaller groups trying to. So it was like two groups only, you and us. So that's why, I guess, it was...
It hadn't occurred to me when you said that. I'm reminded that when we came into that larger group, everybody came back around the table and it felt like a class again. Because we were all this way instead of people being in small groups. So that was a place where the situation kind of forced that look to an external authority figure or whatever. So you said I set the rules. I do, but if I set the rules and you don't abide by them, what happens?
Well, we are obliged to a specific relationship.
Mm-hmm.
In the class. You set the rules there is 2.5 hours, that's what we're supposed to do.
Right. But, well, and those rules are even set outside, but what would happen if ITP as a whole just stopped abiding by those rules?
Again?
If ITP as a whole just stopped abiding by certain rules.
Well, I mean, what would really get done? You'd still have production, but you'd have production without direction.
Right.
You know,
right.
You need to get a conch.
Right.
But I don't think it's in this. I don't remember if this has been in a reading we've done yet, but the observation that looting is essentially what happens when the police can no longer pursue people breaking the law one or a few at a time. And looting is one of those situations where when you see the whole group acting that way, there's nothing the police can do. And you realize how much of the enforcement of the rules is the idea that 90% of the people abide by the rules so that the 10% can be dealt with as exceptions. And looting is a situation in which the exception becomes the rule, and the people responsible for, enforcing the rules become overwhelmed and often absent themselves. In fact, you know, several hundred people have resigned from the New Orleans police force because, in part, because just the normative of that situation essentially undid the social fabric of New Orleans for a while. What do we need rules for? Why do we have them?
Well, I mean,
I know it's an obvious question, but I'm trying to elicit. I'm not suggesting it's a complicated question, but it's one that is worth discussing.
I mean,
to know how to draft, like the rules of a game, you know, rules of a game.
Right. To know how to interact. And what will save us from?
We'll save us from relearning it every time we enter the same situation.
I'm thinking.
Yeah, the first thing that occurred to me when you said
say
that.
Right?
Yeah, save us from thinking.
Right. The first thing that occurred to me when you posed that question was Beowulf. Like, the old, whatever, you know, Nordic or whatever it was. Apparently it was, the first kind of token of written literature. The book was actually about, formalizing rules of war, so that there isn't constant chaos.
What do rules defend us from? What do rules keep from having happened?
What you talk about, this violent process, having to always decide how to decide.
Keeps us from making new rules.
That's interesting. Right, it keeps you from making new rules as well, right? When there's existing social norms, new social norms have a harder time arriving.
It has a survival function to a certain extent.
Why?
So that the kind of rules are usually established as a means of ensuring continuity, and that things kind of can survive beyond the individual interests and instincts.
So who do rules defend us from?
Ourselves.
Or the
just a question based on what you were saying, like they save us from doing rules. I'm a bit of a problem with rules. There are lots of different flavors of them. You have rules as platform. Some of you mentioned play and games and play version rules often. And you have generative rules and you have restrictive rules. At least that's very, in my mind, blunt distinctions. But not all rules are equal.
Right, no, yeah, I don't want to suggest that there's uniformity rules, but just that. And we're in part reacting to a particular exercise we did in the first class where groups, we had to decide where to write a check, groups of 2, then 6, then 12, then 24, until we came to a group decision.
Correct.
And each one of those points, we needed some kind of rule. And the rule was, no one outside this room knew or cared what we were doing, and yet we needed rules. We needed the rules to defend ourselves from ourselves. Because the potential for chaos and bad feeling and so forth, if the rules get, if people get trampled, was too high. And in particular, in that moment where we came back, and for all the reasons that we said, right, someone suggested voting, and then we quickly went to that. And then I was asked to count, nominally because I think it would be easier for an outsider to count, but also because you didn't have to worry about whether I was going to skew the count in favor of my vote, since I wasn't voting. And so, restrictive rules are very often put in place, most often put in place, in fact, as a defense of the group against itself. Bind calls those two are just basic and sophisticated groups. Basic in the sense of more base, his belief is that groups that don't have relatively sophisticated charters tend to either go into groups for pairing off, groups for fight or flight, or groups of religious veneration. And
in a way, group is the contract between the individual and the group. The rules are the contract between the individual and the group. If you want to be, or if you are, it doesn't matter if you want to be. If you are a part of a certain group, and this is your commitment to the group for the continuity of the group.
Yep.
And that's the rules are the glue of the individuals to become. Even if the rules are,
the social contract.
Right. It's a social fact. I mean, to bring you back to the first set of readings, Philip Dick said, "Reality is whatever. When you stop believing in it, it doesn't go away." Right. And that's true of physical logic, but that's also true of attributes of the group. Right.
I mean, you can bring it back to the French Revolution. That's the social contract that's formed and like. But then it can also be imposed, and that's where the problem comes on.
So there are lots of different ways of using using force. The interesting thing about the French Revolution, actually, we'll save it for the Mansion Olson, because there's a question about force underneath all of these things, which is more related to Olson than volume. Two other things I want to pull out. Think about yourselves in that first week, or in the design, in writing your paper, when you were looking at these groups. Is a group better analyzed as a collection of individuals operating autonomously and pooling resources and interests, or is it better analyzed as a unit?
For whom?
So what would help you choose between those things?
Scale.
Scale, okay. So which is which?
Well, I mean, it, depending on what level you're looking at, like, it's irrelevant. You know, if you're looking at ITP as a school, well, then you probably want to look mostly at groups. I mean, there's probably a few key individuals, like Red, that you need to look at as an individual. But mostly you look at it as a collection of groups, whereas if you're looking at this room and what's going on, like, it might be better to look at it on an individual level.
Right. And what's Bayan's illustration for that? The one graph, the Necker cube that when you look at
like
it,
it's A or B,
right?
Yeah.
And it's always both, and you can never make it stay one way or the other for very long. So his formulation in what is a kind of, unfortunately, dryly written chapter, which there's nothing I can do about that, but the one phrase that really, actually two phrases really jumped out at me. One is the idea that we're hopelessly committed to both. When you come down to the question of, you look at individuals or groups, people are hopelessly committed to both. The only person who completely fits into a group is a person who completely subsumes their identity to the group, which is essentially cult membership. That is one way of getting out of the problem. The other way of getting out of the problem is to completely opt out. I'm sitting in the room, but I'm not really here. Right? And I think everyone has probably done that at some point, and some people have also seen other people doing it. In between, the nice thing about either of those ways of doing it is there's at least comfort. Right, because you've gotten rid of the problem. The middle way is to experience constant tension between autonomy and group membership, and that is as true in the situation Brian is documenting as it is in various situations we've been talking about here in this class. The other phrase that left out was hatred of learning from experience. What did that mean, and how is that relevant to graduate?
Well, you get into a group context in order to benefit from the shared knowledge and acquire it.
Right. And yet,
not having to go through the entire process on your own.
Right. Right. You'd like to just arrive at the end state, at the nirvana state of now I know what I need to know. If ITP could be administered as a pill, that would be the ideal.
Could it?
Right. Now, yeah, I know Kung Fu.
Isn't there a quote that goes something like experience is the worst teacher because it gives the test before it presents the information or something like that?
There is some, the formulation I know is good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. But that's effectively the dilemma of learning from experience. And I think you will find that. I think one of the things about PCOM, I'm one of the people, I get the vapors when I see somebody changing RAM. Right? I don't understand PCOM. I've never, I last burned solder on my fingertips when I was a kid working on a Radio Shack thing. And my sense is that anything that touches physical devices has at least some component that can't be taught, but it can be learned. Right? And that, I think, is one of the differences between PCOM and some of the other disciplines here, is that there's much more learning by doing as a necessary component of picking up the skills, even for people with very high empathy. And that's the learning by experience problem. And group situations are learning by experience par excellence. Like being part of the group, there's very little replacement for that. And groups go through, they go through long periods. And groups don't really form until they have their first crisis. Struck by a woman who used to work for me when I was running a web shop, later ended up, ran into her, asked what she was doing. She was moving to London. I said, "What's your degree?" And she said, "Well, I've fallen in love." I said, "Oh, wonderful. This is crazy. Who's the guy?" And she tells me about it. I said, "How long have you been together?" And she said, "About 3 months." She said, "It's really perfect. We've been together 3 months and we've never had a fight."
Oh, no. And, you know, would you move across the ocean for someone you've never fought with? Because, of course, it hasn't, the relationship hasn't really started until after the first fight. And that's true of groups as well as of couples, obviously. And it's the hatred of learning by experience is having to find the boundaries by crossing them. And everyone would like to not do that, but there's no way out of the problem. So that's the other thing that I think left out. Switching gears to the Olsen. Radically different, you know, totally different domain, totally different set of concerns, same tension between the individual and the group. Let me get the Olsen by asking this question. Why do we pay taxes? Why is the tax system set up the way it is?
Well, we pay taxes because if we don't, we'll be arrested.
Well, right. That's right. That's actually, you know, that in fact is the reason we pay taxes. Right. What's the higher order reason?
The benefit of paying taxes.
What's the benefit of paying taxes other than not paying taxes?
The social good.
The social good, right? The public good.
Public good.
So what do we get out of paying taxes?
Military. Public services.
Public services, right? They educate my kids. They pick up my garbage. They do my recycling. The roads don't have so many potholes. Too many used to.
But isn't the question he raises not only why do we pay taxes, but why are we? Do we have to force each other to pay taxes?
So David led with that question, but right, why is there coercion involved? Right, I like having my garbage picked up. Right, I've been to a couple of garbage strikes in this town, and they are no fun. Right, I like having the subway work better than it used to. Right, I like my roads having the potholes fixed. Right, so I'm getting all of these benefits. Right, now when I like bagels, I go buy a bagel. When I like books, I go buy a book. Right. So here's a situation where my money is being spent to provision for me something that I like. But Amazon doesn't come around every month and say, time to buy a book now, right? They're perfectly willing to sit there.
They don't have Amazon comps, right? They're perfectly willing to sit there in a non-coercive fashion and take my money. But the city of New York is not. Those guys have cuts. Right? And I mean, obviously, not the first order of tax collectors, but at some point, somebody comes to your door, and there is an aura of physical coercion. Yeah, they don't have guns in your town.
No, I was just thinking about Amazon's getting a space program, so they're probably...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, well, Amazon and Google are going to have meetings in space outside of the constitutional limits instead of cartel. But why are taxes coerced since the value's obvious?
Well, I think for the most part, maybe a lot of people... To many people, the benefits are transparent in that it's kind of always been that way. So they don't see exactly what it is that their tax money is going into. And so they think, well, you know, what am I really paying all this money for? And some people may want their roads perfectly paved, but they don't care about the subway because they drive. Well, some of my money's going to the subway, but I don't have any say in that.
Doesn't he kind of implies that a group, the individuals in a group don't have the intelligence somehow to understand that.
It's not intelligent. The libertarian argument is that groups are intelligent enough to provision what they need. Olson's argument is it's not so much a failure of intelligence, they're in fact acting rationally. Mm-hmm. Right? There's an old joke. A guy sends his son to sleepaway camp for the first time. They get there, they're unpacking his bunk, and the camp counselors look and say, oh, you forgot to write your kid's name on all the clothes. You know, we sent you the rules that say, write your kid's name on all the clothes. And the father says, oh, that's easy. If you find anything without a name on it, it's my son's. That's the argument for paying taxes. Right? That's the argument, rather, about paying taxes. So why is coercion required to get people to pay taxes, but it's not required for Amazon?
One point, all the examples that you use, potholes, garbage, buying bagels, subway, local, somebody over there said national defense.
Right.
And in terms of...
Right. That's...
What you remember is benefiting you in terms of distance and being in the world around you.
And also things that you don't necessarily support.
Right.
You don't support the idea.
It is a tragedy of the commons. That's exactly right. But so, what is that tragedy?
It's that, you know, you won't pay for it if you don't have it. You know, it's like they, everyone will, like, you'll freeload, or you'll, because, you know, you're not paying directly for the park bench, so why would you if everyone can use it?
Right.
he was also saying that, like, like if it's a really large group, each individual, if you don't do whatever is required, you don't really notice the change. So you figure that it won't really make a difference, but suddenly everybody's going to do that. So then it says something doesn't happen that was supposed to happen.
Right. They can't stop you from taking advantage of it.
So let's say this is one table, right? And you and I were to lift it from the other end, but I actually didn't do any work. Would it be pretty obvious who wasn't going their way?
Sure.
Yeah.
If the whole class was around it and only I wasn't really lifting, could you tell? Yeah. Right. And so that's the dilemma. That's why taxes are coercive. Is that the and Olson's argument, the political background of this is that there was a group suggesting that unions had somehow been corrupted. And that you could have unions that were completely non-coercive. Unions were notoriously using considerable force to either get people to join or to prevent people from leaving and so forth. And there were a number of people saying that that is necessary, unions, because the self-interest of all the members is to come together. This is what underlies Marx's argument. Self-interest of all the members to come together will drive them together. And what Olson said is, no, actually, social loafing is the rational choice. If I can get all the benefit with none of the effort, what could be more economically rational than that? So past a certain point for any given problem, and that point is gotten at with scale, the group requires a degree of coercion to keep people in line with it. Yeah.
I'm just thinking that since taxes is this ancient idea that started very old times, what if we cooperate with taxes today? And it's like you're saying, each one would pay for whatever they think that would be necessary for them.
What would happen?
In theory, I like the idea, but I'm not sure it would really work.
Yeah, I'm just, you know.
What would happen?
I like the idea. What, you know.
What's that?
Like, taxes would be privatized. And
libertarians have been proposing that for some time, that taxes would be privatized. There have also been a number of groups who say, I'd like to be able to pay my taxes, but specify where it goes.
I think you're going to get a bunch of people who pay for the things that are most important to them and other services that they don't necessarily need. No one's going to pay for, but there are people.
Well, what happens
to
Medicaid?
The elderly don't pay, you know, their proportionate amount of tax, so who's going to pay for Medicaid? And obviously they need it.
You wouldn't even have highways, I don't think, because you would only pay for your section of highway or whatever, you know. So you wouldn't be able to get from... decided to go.
What do I care if somebody from Denver can get to Salt Lake City? I hate both of those towns, right?
Pay for the patch of sidewalk in front of my apartment.
It also becomes kind of the more power, the more money you have to invest, the more you are is making a world that corresponds to
that's true,
your own needs.
Yeah, gives you a lot more power.
That's the main, the amount of this investment is the fundamental difference between governments. Like I personally have a huge cultural shock when I'm coming here, as far as how much of the public good is actually given to the everyday citizen, or in my case, non-citizen, and that's the main. And I keep on having the reference of the kibbutz, from Israel, which is like the radical and communist unit, which basically says, and you were giving the examples of food and books, which are all like you can buy books, and when you're going to the city, you can buy your own food from the allowance you get from kibbutz, but basically you eat together and you've got your own library, and everybody has the kibbutz's cars, and if one of the members of the kibbutz bought the car, then the kibbutz was beginning to deteriorate, and these are the main crises in the kibbutz. So
in 1968, an anarchist group called Provo, for provocation, bought a bunch of flight bicycles and made them available to the group. They went for the kibbutz organizational principle. And they said, take a white bike, ride it from point A to point B, leave it at point B. Somebody coming along at point B will get on it and ride it around. What happened? What do you think happened there?
I remember hearing about this, but I don't remember what the results were.
People painted the bikes.
Less than a month, and every bike was either stolen or in the canal.
But isn't that cultural, though?
Because they do that in Northern Europe in a few places where they have bikes just flying around the city.
How do they make it work in those places?
You put money in the machine, and then but you get the money back whenever you put it back in it.
That past a certain scale, the reputation system of the kibbutz breaks down. Because there's not, what's holding people in place to not extract resources from the system?
It doesn't work with the kibbutz scale as well. the kibbutz is falling apart.
Right.
That's for. Yeah, I mean, when you're in such a large area, what you do, you don't see its effects on the group. But it's a smaller group, and, you know, I don't know, you're spending money recklessly, and the group suffers. You see the way the group suffers.
Right.
And there's accountability.
So that is one of the things that Olson's talking about. The pressures of scale. Big groups are different than little groups because the subdivision of your supply of value becomes undetectable. Right? I can sort of start to opt out of these systems. And engage in what's called social loafing. And as long as the cost of detecting and punishing me is higher than the cost of just letting me go, I'm allowed to free ride. Yes. When those costs rise too high, the group begins to break down.
Well, a lot of that like rides on the whole like economic man assumption, though, that people are making these sort of cost calculations, which is not always true.
Right. There was actually really interesting research done recently would suggest that people have a heightened desire to punish and detect defection, even when it doesn't make economic sense. So we're actually able to hold groups together at a higher rate than is predicted by Olson because of that. But even with that structure in place, there are points past which groups become so anonymous that negative actions, like stealing a white bicycle, become impossible to deflect without doing things like taking money, making you personally accountable, because group accountability breaks down in urban areas, unless it's, you know, sort of for really extreme acts of unsociality. So, did anything else? Yeah.
I had a question. Like, we did keep talking about how the pressures of what the individual wants break down the group, but is individual autonomy necessary for a group to exist?
Yes, also. But both of those things are true. It's a big difference between us and ants and bees. I mean, of all social animals, we have the ability to have both adult human intelligence and also primal membership in a group. And the tension between those two things, which is what the Bayan reading was about, is a big part of what drives groups. How do you make something where people are comfortable engaging their autonomy and individuality while still getting the kinds of things done only groups? In some cases, you get voluntary associations, the kind of value being created in the firmware lab, right? You're relying on each individual to participate in sharing their knowledge. And right, when you get a Jamie Allen, when you get somebody who seems to live and breathe that stuff, right, there's obviously a transfer from individuals. But there's also complicated social rules about don't touch my stuff. It's a mess, but don't touch it. And both of those things are necessary to hold the firmware lab together. So there's no settling on either extreme, right? An atomized group is just an atomized group. It's no different than the collective people in a subway car. A group that's completely, utterly focused on a single idea, if it's the wrong idea, they're all going to go off the cliff, right? You want heterogeneity of opinion and so forth. And so balancing those two things and finding some way for the balance to swing across various points, you've got to be able to both have but also resolve conflict. And you need both have. Okay. Take a break, and we'll come back. We will talk a little bit about the coast reading wire firms, the size they are, and I will get Mr. Johnson. Do you want to do USB?
No, no.